Gary and Sabrina. All right. That was just a little bit of okay. You know, we chose joy right here at this place. Joy is one of the core values of Unity Church of Lawrence. I choose joy. Let's see. Now, Brené Brown, author, professor, lecturer, and a very wise woman, in her book, The Gifts of Imperfection, tells about her experience, not of joy, but of stress and anxiety. And I just want to tell her story as she tells it, as we start this morning. She says, after this research first emerged, I made a beeline for my therapist's office. I knew my life was out of balance. I also wanted to figure out why I was having dizzy spells whenever I got really anxious and stressed out. I would actually get lightheaded, and the room would start to spin, and a couple times I literally fell over. I remember telling Diana, my therapist, I can't function this way. I really can't. And she replied, I know, I see that. What do you think you need? And I thought about it for a second, and I said, I need a way to stay on my feet when I'm really anxious. And she just sat there, and she nodded her head, waiting, like all therapists do, waiting and waiting. And waiting, and finally it dawned on me, oh, I get it. I can't function this way. I can't function in this anxiety anymore. I don't need to figure out a way to keep on my feet with this level of anxiety. I need to figure out how to be less anxious. A very wise woman. So she goes on to encourage her readers, that is us, to become intentional about releasing our anxiety and our own overperforming in order to live a more wholehearted life. So Brené suggests that cultivating sleep and play, calm and stillness in our daily lives will allow us to find a more lasting joy and more wholehearted satisfaction in our lives. Now, this sounds wonderful. And how are we going to create and cultivate these positive behaviors when we're so tied up with our conditioned response of anxiety that wakes us up in the middle of the night and has our insides all in a knot? So Brené gives a couple of practices, and you have probably heard them before. One is to stop and count to 10 before you respond in your anxiety. Now, when she says count to 10, I'm sure she does not mean you go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and then blurt out whatever it is. That kind of is a self-defeating practice. I think she is suggesting that before we do that emotional knee-jerk response, that we put enough space in our life to say, perhaps I do not know enough about this situation to become upset. And borrowing a couple ideas from Byron Katie, we could ask those follow-up questions are, is it true? And can I know for sure that this is true? And taking time then to breathe into these questions allows us to move into a more balanced perspective that can lead us into what Brené calls calm. And she defines calm as creating perspective and mindfulness while managing emotional reactivity. Let me say that again. Calm is creating perspective and mindfulness while managing emotional reactivity. So, as a practice, for a minute, just a minute, pick something in your life that you have anxiety around. And I'm sure something just popped right up. Now, imagine. Imagine you could react to that condition with mindfulness. That you could create a perspective that would allow you to be calm in that situation. What would that feel like? Connect just for a minute. What would it feel like to be calm in that? It'd be very nice, would it not? So, when I read this chapter, I was not sold on the idea that just breathing and waiting to respond would make that space for me. And then I realized that she had paired two wholehearted traits in this chapter, calm and stillness. And she defines stillness this way. It is opening an emotionally cluttered free space and allowing ourselves to feel, think, dream, and question. So, stillness is opening an emotionally clutter-free space and allowing ourselves to feel, think, dream, and question. And I got it. Stillness is what we do on the inside, and calm is what we do on the outside. They go hand in hand and help us to create this mindful response in our life when we are anxious. Now, this idea of stillness is a natural match to unity's idea of silence. That inner state of openness to spirit that happens when we become very still in body and in mind. And the idea of becoming still to come into that silence was a core teaching for both Charles and Myrtle Fillmore, co-founders of Unity. Myrtle was a great letter writer. She responded to thousands of people that asked her advice, and her book, Healing Letters, is a collection of some of her responses. And in this, she says to one person, "A period of quiet and rest each day is your opportunity to establish yourself at the center of your being, the one place where the supply of life and substance is inexhaustible. God is this eternal life that we make into living. Each day you should have a period of stillness when the soul may gather sustaining power and restoring life. God gives freely. It is for us to keep the receiving channels open." It is for us to keep those channels open. We become still on the inside in order to be calm on the outside. Now, this isn't the first time that we have seen different characteristics perform an inner and an outer function. Remember the SQ21 material from Cindy Wigglesworth? She identifies spiritual intelligence as the ability to behave with wisdom and compassion while maintaining inner and outer peace, regardless of the situation. It is that idea of being still on the inside and calm on the outside. Wisdom and compassion, stillness and calm. When we use those practices to become still, we can be calm. Now, there are many meditative practices that will take us into our center and help still our minds. And two of the most common are sitting meditation, where we focus on the breath or on a mantra, and a walking meditation, where we focus on the physical act of walking or a mantra. But whatever form of stillness that you choose, it is the daily practice that allows spirit to become more conscious in our lives. Now, just as Brené paired calm and stillness, she also paired rest and play. And she called them characteristics of wholehearted living. So on a day like this, when we all got an extra hour's sleep, I probably do not need to tell you how important it is to have enough rest for our bodies. And usually, most of us here probably sleep less than we need. You see, we human beings, and especially we Americans, are trained to value ourselves by how much we produce in our life. And taking time to sleep sometimes becomes an act of devaluing ourselves by taking time away from production in order to not do anything except sleep. And this is a misplaced value, I believe. And it is up to us to be conscious of what we choose to value. So like sleep, play is often lost in this adult world. Do you ever play on purpose? Now, I know some of you do because we have talked, we have shared play stories. And especially if you have very little children, you obviously get drug into play. Now, as a child, I used to be a wonderful player. But as an adult, there have been years in my life in which they have kind of disappeared without me making a conscious choice to make play a part of my life. So, for just a moment, we're going to do this again. Close your eyes and remember playing as a young child. A child young enough that you haven't even gone to school yet. So think, what did you play? Have you got a memory? Okay, if so, open your eyes. And does anyone care to share how they used to play as a child? Oh, all right. Give me a...
Some of you may know that my sister Yvonne is like 12 years older than I am. And so a lot of times we would ring off my mom's bed and it became the tickle zone. And I would beg her to just tickle me until I couldn't take it anymore. That was my fun.
Whoa, tickle play. Anybody else? How you played as that young child? Anybody? Yes. All right, Ginger.
I'm a farm girl from central Illinois, and we had a screened-in porch on our house, and I can remember the dining room was where you entered from that screened-in porch, and I can remember assembling my dolls and all of their clothes and a doll bed, and I would move the parts and the pieces back between and have great imaginary times.
All right. Anybody else? Okay, Frank.
I definitely remember my brother and I would go out into the woods and into the cornfields and way out. We'd find an abandoned barn and find things in the haylofts and stuff. It's totally fun just being out there, which is why to this very day I love going out into nature.
Totally fun. Well, I can remember as a young child. Now, I had to really stop, actually, and really think about it and to dredge up those memories because they weren't exactly on the top of my mindset when I started thinking about this. But I can remember building a pyramid of twigs and calling it a campfire and running around the neighborhood with the other kids, and they were either chasing me or I was chasing them. And sometimes we were cowboys, and sometimes we were robbers, and sometimes pirates, and, sometimes we were wolves. And we made a cave under the bushes, and we always turned the backyard into an adventure
with our imaginations. And I imagine you can resonate with that kind of play as a child. Some of our games were competitive, and some of them were collaborative. But they all took us to an imaginative place. There's a playmaster by the name of Bernard de Koven, and he wrote a book called The Playful Path. And in here he says, "A playful path is the shortest road to happiness. When you are feeling, being playful, you are walking a playful path. When you are having fun, when you are graceful, when you are in harmony with yourself and the world, when you feel alive and are delighted and delightful, surprised and surprising, loving, caring, you are dancing on a playful path." Well, young play is very unstructured and dances on that playful path. I know that was my experience. Social scientists who have studied play say that it serves a very clear developmental function in human beings. Play is a primary vehicle for physical, cognitive, and social development. Little babies play with their fingers and their toes and their tongues and their voices, all to learn how to work their bodies. Peekaboo with an infant is cognitive play. Where did that other person go? I asked my granddaughter what she liked to play, and she gave a very six-year-old answer: tag and hide and seek. And my five-year-old grandson loves to play the game of egg. Now, egg is where I sit on one end of the sofa, and he lays on the other end of the sofa, and I have to cover him up with a blanket or a quilt, and he is an egg that is getting ready to hatch. And when he hatches, anything can emerge from that egg. It can be a grandpa eating dinosaur, or it can be a friendly kitten, or it can be a non-specific monster. But if a monster hatches that is unfriendly, there is always a friendly one nearby that can help me out. Now, James can play egg for an hour at a time, hatching again and again and again. And it's pure imagination at work. Brené Brown believes that wholehearted people are adults that have relearned or never forgotten how to play. And there's also a deep spiritual principle embedded into play. The Hindu tradition calls it Leela, divine play. The idea behind Leela is that the divine oneness became bored and decided to play, creating this material universe, and it split its oneness into fragments, entering the material universe to interact and to experience the countless aspects of being. Thus, we are now part of Leela, the divine play of God. And if we allow that this is possible, it influences how we act with one another. We see the divine in each other, in spite of outer appearances or conditions. We treat each other with respect, and we know that this life is imaginative play. It is possible that Shakespeare was totally correct when he wrote, "All the world's a stage, and all the men and women merely players. They have their exits and their entrances, and one man in his time plays many parts." If Shakespeare and the Hindus are right, we are always playing roles in the divine play of Leela. And bringing play back into our wholehearted lives is vitally important. Bernard de Koven, playmaster, writes this truth. He shares, The other day, I found myself writing about what it means to follow a playful path. I was working on the PR piece, listing all the callings that could benefit from following such a path. You know, the playful teacher, the playful architect, the playful gardener. And then I thought of firefighters, and then of the police and the military, and I wasn't so sure that I wanted them to be following the playful path, a playful firefighter. He says, but I spent a week with the firefighters exploring a playful path, and we reached a genuine heights of playfulness, and we saw that it was very good. Because I guess there is so much more to firefighting than holding down a high-pressure hose. There's living together and working together and the profound joy of risking together and winning together. And then I realized that to stay on the playful path, you merely have to play fully. I end his quote. We too, as a congregation of wholehearted people, live together, work together, and experience the profound joy of playing together. So may we cultivate sleep and play, calm and stillness into our daily lives, and live with a lasting joy and wholehearted satisfaction of life. Namaste.